Emma Burnell. I blog at Scarlet Standard, and welcome to the 51st edition of the House of Commons podcast. I'm afraid that once again I don't have my compadre, Mark Thompson, with me. He's off living the life of Riley on St. Patrick's Day, which is the day that we're recording, which is obviously very appropriate. But I am absolutely delighted to say that I have with me Nick Dennis, who's a blogger from Platform 10, a modern liberal conservative group. Hello, Nick.
Hi, Emma. Thanks for having me.
Thank you very much for coming on. So, it's quite a lot to talk about this week. It's been quite an interesting political week that's just gone, and we've got an interesting political week coming up. Obviously, the number one issue is going to be the budget. Lots of people with lots of things they're hoping to see in it. Nick, what do you think should be in there?
Well, I actually think the budget isn't that important, really. Because what's important is the, shall we call it the Plan A strategy. So the government sets out what needs to be spent, how much money it needs to get back. And essentially the budget each year is really a shuffling of the cards because there is no extra money. We're probably going to find out there's actually less money than we thought that there was. So really what's going to happen on budget day is, you know, there might be some announcements around things like house building, maybe delaying the fuel duty increase again, which will obviously be popular. But the real issue is going to be for the spending review, which is going to be completed probably in the in June.
You say the budget's not very important, but I think we could probably mark last year's budget as the moment it really all started to go wrong for this government. Certainly, it may not be important in policy terms, but politically, there's very little like it. And it is a place where a chancellor who is slightly more fleet of foot maybe can actually pull a few levers, make a few changes, make a few differences, because once again, George Osborne is going to have to stand up and say that he's failing on his own terms.
Well, I mean, the problem with last year's budget was it was too clever by half, in the same way that Gordon Brown's 10p tax cut thing was too clever by half as well, you see. So I think there's a lot of pressure on chancellors in order to do something to sort of grab the news, to show that they're doing stuff, but then they have to work within the fiscal constraint that there is. So for instance, last year, George Osborne, of course, the big thing was like dropping the 50p down to 45p. Mm-hmm. But in order to try and balance the books or balance them within the parameters that have been set, they came up with a lot of other things like pasty tax,
granny tax,
caravans, I don't know, any sort of stitching, maybe any sort of like weird little hobby that people do. And
are you saying that eating pasties is a weird little hobby, Nick?
Well, it's not a weird little hobby, it's actually a lifestyle choice. But one of the funny things after the pasty taxing, which is, you know, I'm a great believer in politics being an important thing and people should be engaged. And, you know, at least the pasty tax engaged a lot of people in politics. And even, you know, when I was walking past Subway, I'd noticed posters outside Subway saying, you know, get rid of the tax on hot toasties. So, you know, anyone who shopped in those type of places were getting political messages. So I suppose from that point of view, I think it was a very good thing.
It was. It did bring a lot more people into the political conversation, which can only ever be a good thing.
Yeah, indeed.
I mean, you say that Plan A is kind of the it, and it's just about reporting back on Plan A and how that's going.
Yeah.
But I think we kind of know how that's going. Not well would be the answer, generally. I mean, George Osborne is not going to be able to stand up and say that he's done any of the things that 2.5 years ago he stood up and said he would do.
I mean, there is... Okay, let's go... Going back to your original question, I'll come to this very important point from your original question. So the problem that he has is that essentially Plan A... Well, Plan A was a plan which is... You know, the idea was that the economy would sort of almost like a Goldilocks sort of slowly, you know, not too hot, not too cold. And you know, the economy had to be reformed after the crash in 2008, but, you know, reformed in such a way that there wasn't a big shock to the economy in terms of maybe big job losses like we had in the early 80s or massive inflation, which, you know, people with mortgages would suffer. So this is the idea about, this is where George Osborne is. He's sort of going through this path here. Now, on let's say the right, you have people saying, well, what you need is this big shot with a shock with tax cuts, and these are the people who are calling for cutting corporation tax, even cutting the 45p down even further. Then on the other side, you have maybe the Keynesians who are saying, well, actually, we're in a depression anyway, or we're in a very big recession, so you might as well borrow in order to get out of it. And what George Osborne's doing is he's trying to do this thing called Plan A in the middle. Now, you're right. I mean, when Plan A was first formed, I think the idea would be that we'd be getting, you know, unimpressive, but at least, you know, half decent levels of growth, maybe about 2 or 3% per year. And it looks like he's probably going to announce that we might have 0.7% growth, if that even. So obviously something's not working. But I suppose what the government would say is that these outside forces, which are a lot more serious than we first understood back in 2010 when Plan A was set, and Plan A is still right, because the first option of cutting is actually could, you know, affect people's lives very greatly, and the second option of borrowing would actually might temporarily uplift the economy, but in the end it'll lead us into a worse problem where we're forced into doing worse solutions.
I mean, obviously that's not necessarily the case, is it? Because there have been plenty of examples in the past of borrowing, invest in what's called invest to save, and borrowing at a very low rate, like we are at the moment, in order to generate further money and things that generate enough to pay back with the interest. So it's not a case of borrowing will necessarily make us worse off in the future. It's the kind of borrowing and the way that you do it, and ensuring that when times are good, you are paying it back rather than simply taking the benefits and doing more with them. So it's a case of balancing that. And I think that, you know, where there is criticism to be made of Labour, and I'm, you know, I accept that there is criticism to be made, is that we did invest in important areas that had been run down, but we didn't put the idea that we'd ended boom and bust was ridiculous, and we should have known that. We should not have got carried away with ourselves, and should have been better at saying, well, okay, you can't just keep spending this money on these projects, you have to have a way of these projects bringing financial back into what the system. But on the other hand, that was when we were in a boom time, and that's the right way to behave in a boom time if you are a Keynesian economist. But it's not the right way to behave when you're at the bottom part of the cycle, and when everybody else is restricting their spending. You know, it's quite, you know, the idea of expansionary fiscal contraction is a misnomer. It's complete nonsense, and it's not the way that it works.
Well, what's interesting is obviously Vince Cable wrote something in the New Statesman last week about how, you know, it's sort of along your lines, really, that borrowing for the right infrastructure projects is beneficial and won't be costly in the end. Now, this was sort of presented as a split, maybe, of George Osborne and, you know, the Conservative Party coalition. But actually, I think the language here is actually bigger than the difference. And I wouldn't be surprised if, especially as we're coming up in the next couple of years, there will be borrowing for big investment projects. I mean, obviously, we've got HS2 or, you know, the transport stuff. In terms of building new houses, I think that's a very big commitment that this government is making and wants to push through, which is very actually unpopular with the grassroots of the Tory party. Live in very nice green places. But so in a way, I think maybe a light version of what you're suggesting is going to happen.
So Plan A plus is possible.
Yeah, and I think, you know, what's quite funny about all this stuff is I think the actual extremes are very, there isn't any extremes in the mainstream political opinion, actually. I mean, if you look at what Plan A is, Plan A is only fractionally different from what Alistair Darling was talking about at the 2010 election. Now, Ed Balls is very good at politics, and, you know, I think it's a very cheeky but very good move to talk about using borrowing for tax cuts in order to stimulate growth, because obviously, you know, that's an issue that he knows will hurt George Osborne on his right hand side. But I, you know, what's very interesting is when you try and compare what the two different parties are talking about or what they're talking about doing, I don't think there's that much difference, really.
There's a difference. There is some difference, and there are some differences of nuance. Yeah, I don't think either of them are talking about being as revolutionary as maybe some people on either side would like them to do. I think that the Miliband approach towards pre-distributionary thinking is quite different. You wouldn't have any pre-distributionary measures in a budget because the point is you get to them before you get to that kind of level. So I don't think that the kind of stuff that Labour are talking about is the kind of thing that you would necessarily see as macroeconomic policy. So, yeah, I think on a macro level, we may be agreeing or not agreeing, but not being as divided
as the rhetoric suggests.
As the rhetoric suggests. But on political level and on where the money goes. And also, I mean, I have to say, housing is my passion. I spent yesterday, it would have to be my passion, I spent 6 hours yesterday at Labour Housing Group, AGM.
People like you make this country a better place.
I do hope that's the case, otherwise what's it all for?
Indeed.
We are building less than we've built since the 1920s at the moment. And there has been, throughout the entire time of this government, rhetoric about building. And I had an exchange with Grant Shapps back when he was still housing minister on Twitter, where he said, if we don't build 270,000 houses a year by the time we're out of government, you can judge me on that. Well, I will. And I do.
Yeah. I think this is a really, really important issue because one of the big problems that which led us to the crash was the overheating housing market.
Yes.
And what you had is you had this mentality of, and this is a mentality across the board, so I'm not blaming people for suffering from this mentality, but you buy a house, let's say you bought a house in 1985 and it cost you £30,000. By the time you got to 2000, the price of your house was now £300,000. Mm. And so you paid off your mortgage and you were sat on this £300,000 property. And you would think, actually, you think, yeah, great, I've earned all this money. And, you know, maybe it's through my great skill or whatever. But actually what was happening is because all other properties were getting so expensive, you really weren't in that great position. In terms of moving. So what you're doing is you're sitting in something worth X. But if you ever wanted to move, then you'd have to spend almost exactly that amount or more to move. But people, you know, got remortgages, borrowing against it, and banks sort of saw how this, you know, the property market was going up. So it's almost like give anybody a loan, give a dog a loan to get a bank, it doesn't matter. Oh, get a house because the house will go up, the house price will go up. And you know, it was that no government really sort of, if let's say food, for instance, if food rose at the percentage increase that houses rose at over the 10-year period, there'd be riots.
Yeah.
On the streets.
I'm seeing a statistic from Shelter that says something like if food had gone up the same amount that rents have gone up, a chicken would now cost something like 50 quid.
Yeah, indeed. And this is it. But because people felt like they were getting rich, they felt like that, you know, no political party or really sort of dealt with it because it was a very difficult thing. And then this has led us to this situation where housing is extremely expensive. We need to tackle this issue and we need to try and make sure in the future that this sort of bubble doesn't happen again. And one of the ways to do that is to build affordable housing in places where people want to live. So, I mean, I'm completely supportive of Nick Bowles, who's one of my favourite ministers, but and Grant Shapps before him, in terms of actually relaxing the planning laws and making sure that these more houses are built. Now, what's really interesting is, from a Conservative perspective, is last Conservative Party conference, there were two hot-button issues. No, three hot-button issues, actually. One was Europe, one was HS2, but the other one was planning. Because there's a lot of Conservative associations in nice-ish areas which have green spaces. And these are the places where people want to build. Now, internally within the party, this is one of the most difficult areas of policy to sell. And one of the reasons why, and we'll probably come on to it later, you know, it's definitely part of one of the reasons why the grassroots, shall we say, are discontented with Cameron. But I'm so pleased that he's doing it and pushing it forward.
Yeah, I mean, I think the localism bill was a bill in many parts, some of which were not dreadful. But there are other real issues. I mean, there seems to be a concerted effort to denigrate the position of social housing with things like the bedroom tax, with things like reducing...
What's the bedroom tax? I didn't realise there was a tax on bedrooms.
You're not going to do the semantic thing, are you, Nick? Because honestly, those people who are suffering really don't know the difference. If you have a problem, if you think the bedroom tax is an issue, tell me why the bedroom tax is a good thing rather than tell me why it shouldn't be called what everyone's calling it.
Well, the thing with the, as the BBC would call it, the so-called bedroom tax, is that, you know, there is a housing issue. And one of the issues is that there are families in social housing who essentially may be three or four kids in a two-bedroom house. And there are people, you know, who have been in the houses in those situations who the kids have left home and they've got maybe three bedrooms and it's one couple. Now, how do you resolve that? How do you, you know, and one side you can sort of see, well, it's this person's home and they've lived in this area, so you can't push them out. But on the other side, it's not fair for the family who need more space. Now, what I
how
do
How many
expect,
houses are there for the people who will be well, hit no, by this to move into?
What I do think is an issue. Is that this has to be, you know, this has to be taken as a whole in terms of houses being built, in terms of opportunities of people to be moving into. And also, I mean, I don't know how it's going to be implemented, all this moving, in terms of moving between different properties, but there should be that should be a well-organised way of doing it.
According to the government's own impact assessment, they don't think 85% of people will move. They think they'll suck up the charge.
Okay.
Which, you know, shows that it's not actually there. It's there as a revenue raiser, not actually to do what it's supposed to do, which is free up these properties.
But the issue I described is a real issue.
The issue you've described is a real issue, but this is not the real solution.
Well, I mean, this is one of the solutions that the government are implementing. And, well, not to want to sound like a hard-nosed Tory, because obviously I'm a nice modern liberal Tory, but if 85% of people are prepared to pay that, maybe they're prepared to pay that because they can afford to pay it.
No, they are not prepared to pay it. They're going to suck up the charge because there's nowhere for them to go. They can't afford to move because they have got no help with the moving costs. They will be missing meals and missing heating. They won't be choosing between heating and eating. They'll be choosing to do neither in order to stay in the homes that they have.
Yeah, I mean, one of the things that I was pleased about, and I know you're going to say this isn't going to go far enough, but, you know, in terms of, you know, thinking about sort of issues with people with disabilities and, you know, maybe needing spare room for certain issues to do with that disability, but hopefully that's going to be rethought. Yeah, I mean, the whole issue with housing is we need to get houses built, and we need to get houses built where people want to live and people can live in order to get to work. And that includes social housing, because social housing is very important. Because, you know, you want as a Conservative, I want people to have security in life and have a base. And
but they're taking away security of tenure.
Well, you're the housing expert, so...
That was one of the things in the localism bill, is that the new so-called affordable rent, and if you want to talk about semantics, that's a great one there. The so-called affordable rent, which is up to 80% of market rent, which is, you can imagine, for people living in social housing in, say, for example, Tower Hamlets,
yeah.
But the average market rent is extremely high because there are very, very high-value properties around gathered around Canary Wharf, but also massive pockets of poverty because, you know, it is traditionally a very poor borough. So 80% of those market rents are enormous. Absolutely, completely unaffordable for people, for huge swathes of the people who have been living in that social housing. So that, you want to go semantics, affordable rent is where well, I would take it. But between the reduction of security of tenure for social tenants, there are huge amount of measures that were there to stop people feeling comfortable and feeling like social housing was an option for life. Was an option that was okay, that wasn't an emergency option. And I don't think that's the right way to approach social housing. I think it should be seen as just as good as any other kind of housing and just the right kind of place for some people who like to live there. And it's really important that we don't make these places ghettos for people who've failed.
Yes, well, I mean, yeah, that's very interesting. Because then at the same time you have an issue of, let's say, let's pick two sort of... high-profile people. Let's pick Frank Dobson and Bob Crowe, both two people who earn a very decent salary, have earned a very decent salary for a long time, and are both living in social housing in their areas. Now, is that correct when other people need social housing?
Well, for me, personally, I think they should be paying a higher rent. I think there should be a mechanism for those who are earning more to pay more rent and to use that rent to build more housing. But yes, they absolutely should be able to stay in their homes. What kind of message does it give to kids in social housing that successful people don't live around here?
Well, but what's the purpose of social housing? And that's the other sort of question. I'm thinking of it in the case of, you know, you have, I don't know the statistics, but you have an amount of people who maybe need social housing or are homeless or on lists who want to get it. And you know, enough houses aren't being built, and that's a very big issue that we need to deal with. But at the same time, if you're living in a social house and you can comfortably afford to move out of that social house, then maybe you should, in order to actually free it up for others who might need it. And now, I hate the idea of stigma at all, and I agree, and it doesn't mean that these places should become ghettos. And one of the great things about London, I think, is that you tend to have, you know, streets apart, very different types of housing, very different types of communities. So unlike maybe somewhere a bit more familiar as well, like Paris, where, you know, it's absolutely terrible what they do, where they have essentially a donut ring around it of desolate, shall we say, and rightly so, ghetto areas. Politics exists because there's difficult decisions to be made. And, you know, the issues that you talk about are completely true, but so are the issues that I talk about. And it's very difficult to do something on this without actually, you know, hurting all some people.
But why are those people always the ones at the bottom?
I don't think that's the case, but...
It just seems to me that the people who are hurting, the ones who are really all in it together, are the ones who can least afford to hurt. You know, the people at the top have had a 5% tax cut. Everyone else is, you know, your VAT's gone up, your wages are depressed, you may be subject to the bedroom tax, you may be subject to massive rises in transport costs. If you don't drive to work, your public transport's gone up through the roof.
I mean, there are big issues here in terms of cost of living, and but you know, I look back at 1997, and I so wish that Cameron would have got the inheritance of 1997 when he came into government, because that governing is so much more fun when you have those resources available to you. But you know, in terms of unemployment, you know, compared to other European countries and even compared to America, we're not doing too bad. In terms of inflation, in terms of it's not too bad. In terms of interest rates for mortgage owners, again, that's not too bad. So, you know, the economy is in a bad shape. It has to be recalibrated. And there are certain issues that are going to happen, but there are also, you know, there's some good things that are happening in terms of this recalibration. It could be a lot worse if you look at other places.
I think it could be a lot worse. I think it could be a lot better. I think if we look at other places that have, for example, embraced more infrastructure spending, embraced more invest to save, they are doing better than us.
So which places?
Well, America for a start. I mean, they have a higher unemployment level, but that's going down. You know, that was inherited and is reducing. But they have actually got a better economy than us at the moment, and they are not, in the same way that we are, bumping along the bottom, about to go into a triple dip recession.
Well, I mean, I would say that, you know, one of the things about America is that, you know, the poorest in their society don't have as good access to education and healthcare as the poorest in our society, for instance. So
that's true, certainly, you know, at the moment.
Crime levels as well are a lot higher in America than they are here. So, you know, there's different things happening in different places.
But we're talking about what's been happening in the last, since the crash. We're not talking about what's traditionally been true for 100 years.
Yeah. Well, I mean, a lot of people I know, conservative and right-wing people, would use America as a place where there's less tax, there's less laws, and it allows businesses to be created, and there's less social, there's less state spending.
Certainly there are things that America gets very wrong. I would agree with that. They have inched closer to a better healthcare system than we have. I know there are some conservatives who consider the NHS a 60-year mistake, but I would hope that you're not one of those, Nick.
No, of course not. I'm not. No, I don't. I mean, you know, there are. I mean, you can always build straw men, but I think most people who vote conservative and definitely most people in government and you know, throughout the whole, you know, since the NHS has been created, think that the idea of the NHS is a great idea. I mean, where I disagree with you, probably, well, almost certainly, that's I don't have an issue with private firms getting involved in the NHS. And that's a big sort of ideological dividing line. I think it's
just ideological. I think I have a problem with it because I don't think it works very well. I think
it does work well. So, but you know, what's most important is that the service delivered to people is the best possible service.
Yep, absolutely.
And is free at point of care. Now, the NHS is so, so important because, and this is, I once had an argument with somebody about private schools because I'm, you know, I hate it when politicians or people in politics talk about their own personal life, but I, you know, I went to a state school and it's all fine, it's very nice and everything, but I had a friend who went to a public school and he said his dad should have got a discount on his tax paid because, you know, he wasn't using state resources. And, you know, but that's the wrong way of thinking about it. In the same way, it's the wrong way of thinking about, I don't use the NHS, so I shouldn't, you know, I should pay for it. Because what counts is the person next to me in the bus queue or the person driving the bus is educated and can have, you know, good health. So it's important to have these things in order to create, you know, a good, equal society or as equal.
We're going
to
make a socialist of you yet, Nick.
Where I disagree with you, but I think, you know, in terms of state being the one monolith provider I disagree with, and I think the private sector, I mean I'm not against, you know, profit making schools, for instance, and those type of things. So that's where I can't be your brother.
Oh, what a shame. I really thought we'd won you over for a moment.
No indeed. I sat to the seed, I'm afraid.
Okay, well, I mean, I think that's probably where our dividing lines are, in terms of, I think that a non profit motive driven organization is more complicated. I remember thinking about this when I was working for a small firm who were a private company and had a kind of public sector ethos. Most of their clients were from voluntary organizations or the public sector. So they very much had the kind of ethos of the public sector, but the simplicity of the bottom line. And the bottom line is a really, really simple measurement of success or failure. It's much, much harder to have measurements of success or failure when you don't have that bottom line, when it's a much more complicated structure. But on the other hand, I do think that the bottom line can be very distracting when what you're actually trying to achieve is something other than profit. If what your organisation's essential purpose is not to make money, then having somebody involved in that whose essential purpose is to make money can be quite, it gives you two targets that aren't necessarily the same.
My position isn't that it must be profit-making companies. I think it's basically all types of organisations. I'm a great fan of mutuals and charities, you know, winning government contracts to deliver stuff as well. So I think it should be the people who can deliver it the best. Now, what you need to make sure is that, you know, things are transparent, so obviously bidding processes are transparent, but also results are transparent. Also, that results and are monitored well as well. And that these things are the things that need to make happen. I mean, I don't believe one is better than the other. What I think is, though, that it should be open to all to bid and try and provide the best service.
I mean, my concern, as has been discussed on this podcast, you'll imagine at length with Mark, is the cherry picking issue. It's very easy to go in and run a good service for 5 years, win the contract, run into the ground any opposition, and then what happens? And this is what we've seen with so many other aspects of our lives. I mean, the energy companies, the phone companies, the railways. Don't get me started on the railways.
Well,
don't forget though.
Everyone thought the railways were terrible when they were nationally owned as well. I mean, you know, and I agree.
At least you had one point of contact.
Yeah, one person to moan at. Yes.
Yeah, exactly.
One enemy.
of people to replace if that's what's needed.
I tell you what, okay, where I am sort of closer to you and more radical in terms of from my own side, shall we say, is I think there is an argument for renationalising energy, water, and maybe even the railways. I think where there's a monopoly, a natural monopoly, shall we say, we shouldn't try and pretend that competition exists within it.
Mm.
And that's I wrote a blog on it once. And I think this is going to be an issue that comes up more and more, especially in terms of the energy companies. Because what you have is these energy companies putting up the prices and saying, oh, it's because gas is expensive on the wholesale market. But then, funny, isn't it, how they keep on making, you know, maybe 5-7% a year, every single year, no matter what happens. You know,
they
always get their latest votes. I'd love to work in a job where basically at the beginning I thought, well, how much money do I need to make my bonus? What do I need to do that? Okay, if I do that, will customers go away? No. Okay, do the customers have to pay? Yes. Okay, I'll do that.
Yeah.
So I do think there is actually an argument.
There is not what I call a cartel of disservice to customers at the moment in many of our biggest industries. You know, they don't need to offer good customer service because nobody else does.
So
it's not something they're competing on.
But I actually don't. But though I think in schools and in provision of healthcare and all those type of things, I actually think the opposite. I think there is potential for different people, not just to compete, but in terms of where do I send my child to, but also as well in terms of running contracts for a certain number of years, proving they can do it. So while I think there is an argument for maybe nationalising energy providers, I think there is an argument for allowing private profit making if they're the best people to operate state schools and provide for the NHS.
I think we're going to go round and round on this one here. We might have to lay this one to bed for now. But I think we found some interesting common ground, though, which is always worth exploring. Now, speaking of common ground, one of the biggest stories of this week has been, follow my leader, or which leader? Theresa May? She may not. I could go on for hours. How much
are you enjoying this, Emma?
I really am. I had to go through the last round. I watched you guys enjoy it. It's my turn now.
We did.
In all honesty, from your opinion, you're obviously a modernising conservative, and you have presumably a dog in the race. But how serious is this?
Okay, well, Cameron will be the leader at the next election.
Okay. Undoubtedly. Yeah, I think that's exactly right, yeah.
But there is a big issue, because obviously at the moment our electoral chances don't look good. If we don't win the next election, or if we can't form a coalition again with the Lib Dems, then Cameron will probably go. Now, people like Theresa May and Chris Grayling I put into this camp as well. They don't necessarily want Cameron to go, but what they want to do is, if he does go, make sure they position themselves to be an option. Now, Theresa May is an interesting example, because she hasn't really ingratiated herself to the grassroots or to the people who will vote for the next leader. First of all, she called us the Nasty Party in 2002.
Yes.
And a lot of people, and most of the people who are still members of the party were members back then, because we haven't been very good at attracting new members. But a lot of people still remember that. She used to be very bad actually at turning up for us doing the rubber chicken circuit, which is very important for these people, turning up at events and speaking. She wasn't very good at that sort of stuff. She's really improved over the last year. Wonder why. And also she's actually an extremely safe politician, always taking the line, parroting it out, doing a very efficient, good job in Home Office, for instance. But
does she know what day it is?
Well, in my opinion. But what she did at the Conservative Home Conference is that she essentially sort of said, here is who I am, here is what I believe in. And for most of us, this was new, because we'd never heard anything saying who she was and what she believed in. So her and Chris Grayling, and Chris Grayling's doing a similar thing using the MOJ brief to, what's interesting about Chris Grayling is, if you look at what he's actually doing, it's no different to what Ken Clark is doing, apart from on the one issue, and that's on the European Court of Human Rights.
Yeah.
That's the only issue where he's very different from Ken Clark. Apart from that, in terms of rehabilitation, all this sort of stuff, his language has changed a lot, and his highlighting of what's happening has changed a lot. And that is to get the headlines in order, and that is the red meat for the people who are going to vote potentially in a future leadership contest. So he's doing a similar thing. Then you got people like Liam Fox, who is I've printed out the Alex Massey from Coffee House wrote a brilliant blog about Liam Fox's speech this week, and in it he said, according to Fox, the greatest socialist coup of the last decade was making wealth an embarrassment. It is not. This is what Fox was saying. It is the price for aspiration, hard work, and its side effects are higher taxes, tax revenues, more jobs, and more investment. Then Alex Massey writes, oh, really? This is, and I apologise for using a technical term here, moronic. Is Fox really ignorant of the fact that in real terms, average earnings have been stagnant for a decade? Is he really unaware that this misfortune has not applied to the wealthiest Britons, whose remuneration has increased considerably in real terms? Now, what Liam Fox is doing, I mean, he obviously has spare time on his hands.
Yes.
And he has friends who obviously take him out to nice restaurants, and they're obviously all quite wealthy, and they all probably believe in this sort of hard work thing that he was talking about. Now, he's sort of like presenting a certain wing of the Tory party's view. Now, he's not a serious candidate, but what he's trying to do is he's trying to make sure that view is represented. And then finally, you've got the guy who I forget his name.
Adam Afrey,
yes, who is absolutely brilliant, because no one really, I mean, we sort of knew about him, and then suddenly he wants to launch leadership. Even though the rules have been changed, so there's no such thing as leadership plot, the stalking horse anymore.
Yeah.
Because how it used to work is somebody used to challenge, and if they got enough letters of support, then they could challenge the leader. But now what happens is MPs just have to write letters to the 1922 committee, and if they get enough, then there's a referendum on whether the leader should stay the leader, and that's amongst MPs. So he's put himself in a position that doesn't exist anymore, which is a very conservative thing to do, actually. but he is very funny, because there are many good backbenchers who do many, many good things, and they don't have to be in government. But I can't think of a single thing that he's done that makes you think, yes, this is leadership material. And I'm not saying he's a bad person or a bad constituency MP, but he's managed to catapult himself into this sort of place where he's talked about as being a leader without actually having done anything which is leadership type of material, as far as I can see.
I mean, forgive me for being cynical, but it strikes me as what Adam Afrey has done has built himself a really nice niche where he will be the go-to guy whenever there's any rumblings. He will get on the telly a lot. He will get to write op-eds where he wouldn't have done previously. He's built himself a career that has nothing to do with ever becoming Conservative Party leader, but everything to do with the future media career of Adam Afrey.
So he's essentially...
John Redwood.
I was going to say Nadine Dorris, because that's what Nadine Dorris is doing.
Another good example.
She's building a very good media career for what might ever happen if she doesn't get the whip back. I don't know him at all or the people around him, but I suspect that he probably believes he can be leader and should be leader, because if you ask out of the 650 MPs who are in Parliament, probably 90% believe they should be leader. you know, get into politics who go that far generally, believe that they have good leadership skills. So, but he through doing this, you're right, he has done this stuff. And he wrote something on Content last week. He wrote something on Coffee House on Friday. But everything he writes is the same. It's quite funny. It's like a little bit The Disaffected. It's, do you know I used to run a business? I'm very loyal, but...
Yeah.
He doesn't, you know, he writes the same, he's written the same type of articles, and all of them I've read them, and I thought, well, I don't know what you're trying to say here, apart from that you're a nice guy, which is all great, and we need more nice guys in the Tory party, of course, but he's got the space, but he hasn't done anything with it.
Yeah, and I think he probably needs to have something, another hook, other than just the guy who might have challenged Cameron.
Yeah, completely.
But let's see if he manages to find himself one. I mean, I can't even really tell from the outside, like, which part of the party he's trying to be attractive to.
Yeah, indeed. Well, that's it. This is quite funny. He's almost launched a campaign before a campaign is even exists. He's almost jumped the step, which is the step for having notoriety. In terms of, let's say, somebody, I'm trying to think of a good example here. Okay, well, this is a bad example, but I'll use it anyway. Mitt Romney or someone like that, who essentially, in terms of trying to get to become in a leadership position, will maybe take positions or be, you know, interesting positions on the right in order to do that. And then once he gets in a leadership position, tries to go back into the centre. And it didn't really work for him in the presidential election. Now, when I read Adam Afrey's stuff, it's almost like he's trying to reposition himself in the centre. But I don't know. I've never heard of him, so I don't know where he's trying to reposition himself from.
Yeah. I think that's quite right.
Anyway, wasted enough time talking about him already.
Well, yeah, this is what he wanted, and this is what he's got. I mean, in those terms, he's been very successful. So, as you say, Cameron is, and I agree with you, I think he's almost certainly going to be the, you know, barring a bus accident, the leader at the next general election. But that doesn't mean the rumblings will go away.
They won't.
You don't think that they'll see an election in sight and get more disciplined in the next, say, 18 months?
Well, they might get more disciplined, but the rumblings won't go away. And that's because, and I went to the Conservative Party Spring Forum on Saturday.
Oh, were there any women there at all?
What, in the audience?
No, on the stage.
On the stage. Well, we had Theresa May. She's a woman. So, and actually the chair of the voluntary party is a lady called Emma Pidley, who was there and she did her chairing thing. So, yes.
She gets to play nanny. That's
she will, you know. There are plenty of women in the Tory party, and there are.
There was the speech we were talking about earlier from Theresa May, was at the Conservative Home conference.
Yes, I went to that as well.
At which there were 3 out of 17 women, 2 of whom were talking about how to win the women's vote.
Yes.
It's not good.
Yes. Well, that was run by a Conservative Home, not the Conservative Party. Mind you, that was a very, very good and interesting conference. I suppose that's something that Tim should look at next year. But, yes.
It won't be Tim when he's off to greater heights, isn't he?
He's still one of the, I don't know what they call him, the consultant on it.
Okay.
So he's still going to be involved in terms of shaping its direction, I think. So. It was very interesting because essentially we were talked at, and it felt like there was this glass between the leadership and the membership. And in some ways I can sympathise with that because the membership have been quite unhappy with Cameron for a while now, and they don't believe that he when Cameron did that famous quote about UKIP, he called him racist fruitcakes and loonies.
That's it.
Now, the problem is that many people who have been in the Conservative associations for a long time and run Conservative associations, they relate and understand and know people in UKIP more than they relate to Cameron and his leadership. And that's and so what Cameron was doing when he was saying that, he was almost dismissing people who are friends of some of these people. Now, you know, whether you agree with him or not. And this has sort of created like a divide. It was almost like he was, you know, insulting them. And I went to that we had like there's a little fringe event at lunchtime for this new group that's been set up. Because one of the issues with the Tory party, I'll let you know, Emma, is there's not enough groups actually doing stuff. So another group has been set up called Grassroots, and I went along to it. And essentially, it was disaffected ex-local association chairman.
Okay. So the guys that we saw on the steps of Number 10 with the letter about equal marriage.
It was them, yes, having a massive moan. Now I sort of sat there in the meeting thinking, the chairman of it described Conservative Grassroots as a broad-ish church, but the ish wasn't wide enough for me. I think it was, I sat there and essentially there's all these people moaning, and none of them talking about how to get new members, which is the biggest issue. Me, you know, obviously you need to widen your membership to include many different parts of society. But the problem is though that there's a disconnect between the leadership and who currently make up the grassroots, which hasn't grown at all in recent years. And while that's happening, there'll always be disaffection.
And it is very interesting. I don't know if you had the chance to listen to the podcast last week.
I did, yes.
We had
I'm a great fan of yours, so I listen every week, and I advise everyone to listen every week. Mind you, if people have listened this far, they must be big fans as well. So.
I would hope so. That's very kind. I'm blushing now. as you know, last week we had Linda Jack and Joe Shaw from the Liberal Democrats. It was after their Spring Forum. And they were talking about the disconnection between their leadership and their membership and how that was probably the biggest issue happening in their party at the moment.
That's interesting. Can I make one point? Sorry to
Please
jump
do.
In.
Yep.
One of the things that was great is that you know, they had this big falling out over secret courts, and I wish Joe and people like Charlotte Henry would have won over that, because it's an issue that I agree. You know, with them, that secret court.
Me too.
But ours, there was no Q&A, there was no interactiveness, there was no policy making. So at least they had an argument, at least they had a discussion. You know, at lunchtime, There were no Tory MPs or hardly any wandering around, none of the leadership. If I was David Cameron, I think, you know,
that's walking the halls.
It's a diary a long time before it happens. Mm. You know, he should be there at lunchtime. So at least they have their disconnect face to face.
Yeah. I mean, it's so familiar. It really is from our time in government. And I'd be very interested to see, and if when touch words, Labour win the next election, whether we go back to that, and whether the current feeling in the Labour Party that the leadership are reaching out, that there is a more engaged party, that there is better dialogue between the leadership MPs and members and the country at whole. I mean, you know, there's this real effort to bring community organising and bring communities into the party and bring them into dialogue with the party. And whether that can and will survive government, or whether what you are seeing at the moment and what the Lib Dems are seeing is a symptom of being in government. And
I think Emma, ours has been a symptom for a long time. So it wasn't just being in government, I'm afraid to say.
Mm. Well, I mean, certainly, I think Cameron's Heir to Blair Act has involved the definition of himself against his party, which was something Blair did all too frequently. I mean, sometimes when it was necessary and sometimes when it was just bloody mindedness and unnecessary, and caused those members who, you know, like me, are loyalist Labour members, who do stay despite disagreeing with a lot of things, because we do think it's the best that we're going to get, just endless pain. There's no need for it. We discussed last week this concept that I'm sort of kicking around called muscular membership, which is where I think as parties are losing money, there just isn't the kind of money there used to be for parties to do politics professionally. Yeah. They rely more and more on members.
Yeah, but Emma, why would you join a political party? All my friends think I'm mad.
Well, this is the case, and what Labour are trying to do at the moment, which is quite interesting, is reach out beyond the kind of people who would join a political party,
yeah,
and just get them involved in some sort of conversation.
Which is a great way of doing it, yeah.
And we've got this great guy whose name has completely escaped my brain at the moment.
Is it Arnie Graff?
Arnie Graff, yeah, who I've seen speak, and is incredibly inspiring. Yeah. And doing some amazing project work all around the country on just making this happen. And, you know, the way he talks about branch meetings is the way we all secretly talk about branch meetings.
Same.
And so it's just getting out of that mindset and getting into the mindset where we're a two-way conversation with the nation.
Yes.
And I think, and making sure that members feel that is not a conversation that's happening over their heads, but that they are an essential part of making happen.
Yeah, yeah. I think the stuff that you're doing with him is fantastic, and I wish we were doing something even close to that. And I think one of our biggest weaknesses is that we've not invested enough in the grassroots in terms of growing it, in terms of making it something that's more relevant to the modern world. And I think we're going to suffer very badly from that at the next election. So, for instance, Eastleigh was a perfect example. We were second, pretty close second in 2010.
Yeah.
But we had an association of less than 100 members. So when the by-election was called, we had no infrastructure. And now this is meant to be one of the seats that we need to win. Now, if we've got no infrastructure and no members on the ground, how are we ever going to win it?
Absolutely. I mean, the pressure of being in government makes being a political party your secondary consideration.
Yes.
I think that's a real issue. And I think that no political party's yet got this right.
Yeah.
And I don't know whether Labour will get its more right next time around, whenever the next time around happens to be.
Yeah.
I hope so. I hope we've learnt the right lessons. And maybe if you do come out of power next time, maybe it will be your turn to learn the right lessons.
Yeah, hopefully. Well, hopefully that won't happen. Hopefully the economic grassroots starts springing up, and that we won't need to worry about that. But I think even if we win, or even if we're in coalition, we need to think long and hard about this.
Yeah, and I think 1% of people in the whole country are members of a political party. Yes. Imagine how many of them are just the fees-paying members. So the activists are a tiny, tiny proportion of the country and make a huge, huge difference to what a political party is able to do. And I think that's the thing that gets forgotten when you're sat in your large suite of offices in number 10 Downing Street making decisions that change the country, that actually there are people who got you there.
Yeah, yeah, very much so.
Well, we're in danger of, as Raphael Baer put it a few weeks, violently agreeing again.
Just remember, I like private companies and hospitals, Emma. So
there you go. Thank you very much. I think that's... I don't. So let's end on that sour note. Thank you ever so much for joining me today, Nick. It's been really, really fascinating.
It's
a really good conversation. And just before we go, Mark should be back next week. Mark fans will be delighted to hear. And I'd just like to take this opportunity to thank Audio Boo for the hosting and Kevin McLeod at incompetech.com for our groovy intro and outro music. And thank you very much for listening.